The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. This conversation is with Professor Brett Wilson, who has composed the first English translation of the classic and controversial novel from late Ottoman context, Nur Baba. This novel presents an engaging and often humorous account of the intrigues and activities of a Biktashi Sufi group in Istanbul and its environs. It offers a fascinating picture of a modernist critique of Sufism in this context. Wilson's translation is both lyrical and captivating and will make for an excellent resource for courses on Sufism and Islam more broadly. Here is my conversation with Professor Brett Wilson. Okay, welcome, Brett, to New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network, and congratulations on this really wonderful achievement, a translation of Nur Baba. Before we get into the conversation, I believe this must be your first time on the New Books Network, so we have a tradition to have authors talk about how they got into the field. So could you just, before we get into Nur Baba and this translation, could you say a little bit about how you got into the study of Islam and your story, your journey?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Sher Ali. It's a pleasure to be here. I got into this field basically because I took some great classes as an undergraduate at the University of South Carolina with Ken Perkins. And because of that, I decided to study abroad and ended up spending a year in Istanbul, Turkey, where I learned Turkish, became fascinated by Ottoman history, Turkish history, and Islam in that context. And to make a long story short, I just kept going in that direction. It never stopped. And here I am today. I studied after that. I went to Duke University, where I studied with Bruce Lawrence and Ibrahim Musa, and I met you and have a lot of great memories from that time. After the PhD, I taught at Macalester College for a number of years, and recently my path took me to Europe and have been teaching in Budapest and now in Vienna for the past 8 years.
Great. So I thought maybe as a way to begin our conversation, we're discussing the translation of a really interesting and engaging novel, and we don't want to give too much away either as part of this conversation. This will be a little different from other monographs that we usually talk about. But perhaps you could just give a brief sense to our listeners about the broad theme of this novel and its context of the late Ottoman context. What is this novel broadly about, and what is the context in which it is composed?
Absolutely. So the novel is a starts out as a kind of classic story of a spiritual quest. There's a young man who is interested in a Sufi lodge in Istanbul, which is a Bektashi Sufi lodge. And he's hesitant to go there, but one of his relatives takes him there. And the novel tells his story of being initiated in the lodge, of spending time there, participating in its ceremonies, and also covers a lot of his perceptions about what happens there. Alongside that, the main character is actually not the narrator, but this female relative of his. And she also joins the lodge together with him, is initiated into the Bektashi order, and she becomes deeply in love with the leader of the lodge, the sheikh, whose name is Nur Baba. And it's a story of attraction, seduction, and along the spiritual quest, I would say. So I don't think there's too many spoilers, Sher Ali. I mean, maybe the ending is it could be a spoiler, but otherwise, I think we can talk about just about anything in there. The context of the composition of the novel is that it's written in the 19-teens in Istanbul, primarily, possibly also in Switzerland. The author, Yakup Kadri Kara Osmanoglu, was from a very distinguished family, which is very powerful in the Ottoman Empire. And he's from a period in which the family had kind of declined and was not so glorious as before. And a lot of his novels and writing deal with the social tensions and crises of late Ottoman and early Turkish Republican society. And so this novel's written at a time of great change during what's called usually the Young Turk period. He begins to write it around 1913, and it's published first in newspapers in 1921, and then as a book, as a novel in 1922. And this is still the Ottoman Empire. It's not the Turkish Republic. And this is a context in which intellectuals like Yakup Kadri were making all kinds of new critiques of religion, and particularly of Islam, I should say, in the public sphere, in new venues like novels, newspapers, journals, etc. So it was a time of great intellectual upheaval. The novel was greeted with a great deal of controversy, as I explained in the introduction. First, the novel was banned. Then there was a film made from the novel. Then the film was banned. And then a few years later, it becomes quite popular with the foundation of the Turkish Republic. So it's a novel written at a very dynamic time, this late Ottoman period when the empire is seen to be falling apart and does fall apart, and a new republic is being imagined as people like Yakup Kadri start to imagine what Turkish identity is, start to critique traditional leaders, Islamic institutions like Sufi lodges, etc.
So you mentioned in the introduction to the novel, a really nice introduction that about the controversy surrounding this novel that you also mentioned a bit right now. I thought there was a fascinating narrative with which you begin the book. And if it is okay, if you could share that with the listeners of how even in the Turkish Republic and with someone like Ataturk, the controversy surrounding this novel was quite palpable, and this very interesting encounter between the author of this novel and Ataturk that you talk about at the beginning of the introduction. Could you share that narrative with our listeners just to get a sense of the degree of controversy this novel has created and perhaps still creates?
Absolutely. So a lot of the discussion around the novel was whether or not it described actual people, real life people. And Ataturk and others had heard this this kind of rumor that it was based on the life of this particular Bektashi sheikh in Istanbul, who happened to be in Ankara visiting. And somewhere in the 1920s or maybe even 1930, we're not exactly sure, Atatürk invites this Bektashi sheikh to visit him at the presidential residence in Ankara. And he also invites at the same time Yakup Kadri Kara Osmanlu to come. And he puts them in this kind of awkward situation where they have to talk to each other and be in the same room after Yakup Kadri has published this really critical, even defamatory novel about a Bektashi sheikh. And so it's funny because Atatürk really hoped that this Bektashi leader would be exactly the same as the character in the novel, that he would be great at singing, that he would be a kind of a party man, that he would be full of life and so forth. And he basically is disappointed that this Bektashi leader seems to be a rather normal person and is not as flamboyant as the novel makes him out to be. And Yakup Kadri basically says, you know, well, he was the raw material of the novel and he shares some things with the character, but not all of them. And he later wrote that he is a womanizer, as was depicted in the novel, and that he was also not very educated. We see numerous examples of this in the novel where the narrator makes fun of the writings of the sheikh, especially of his poetry and his songs that he writes, which he says don't really have, don't follow the meter properly, don't have very good flow, etc. And so this incident with Atatürk in the presidential mansion with the author and the Bektashi sheikh really show that this novel was such a source of public discussion and controversy that it even reached the highest offices of state, right? If you're an author and you get invited to the White House or the Kremlin to discuss your novel, you can say that novel has made a pretty important impact. And that was the case here. And so I included that story to kind of, you know, make it clear to the reader that what they're about to encounter was something that was on the mouths and on the minds of some of the greatest intellectuals and the most powerful people in the country at the time.
Let's perhaps think a bit and talk a bit about a couple of the characters in the novel, and then we can look at a couple of themes as well. So let's begin with one of the key protagonists, which is Noor Baba himself. What is your reading of, you know, I found it very interesting that on the one hand, you know, he seems a bit eccentric and, sensuous and so on. But on the other hand, he does have some properties and characteristics of quote-unquote traditional Sufi masters in the kind of charisma that he attracts and, you know, a certain kind of master-disciple relationship in some ways, which is operative here. So what do you make of this character in terms of how the author is trying to portray him as? But then as a translator, what kind of a figure, how do we conceptualize this figure as a Sufi master? What are some of the key tensions maybe inhering in this character for you, the character of Noor Baba?
Sure, that's a fantastic question. So I would say the character draws on some themes from the late Ottoman period, one of which was that the main critique of Sufism was that the leaders were charlatans. They could be charlatans of different kinds. They could be people who were interested in money, interested in power, interested in women, a variety of things. And we can see that Yakup Kadri really drew on these themes in creating the character, because he basically says that Noor Baba was all of these things. Now, at the same time, you're right. He is a charismatic figure. He has an amazing voice. He brings the disciples together in a very commanding way. But his way of bringing them together is actually too powerful. It's so powerful that it's damaging, because the female disciples almost to a fault fall in love with him, have romantic relationships or affairs with him, and usually end up giving all of their wealth to him, or at least a large part of it. And we see many of these characters end up badly in the novel. There's one who jumps out of a window and breaks her legs and is paralyzed for life because he stopped loving her. We have another who has kind of lost all of her money because of him. We have several others who leave and destroy their families because they're obsessed with the sheikh. And so he does have some, let's say, leadership qualities in terms of leading rituals, in terms of being a good musician. But for Yaqub Kadri, he lacks the important things. He, for example, he when he asks him questions about Sufi concepts or rituals or art, he's always disappointed with the answers that the sheikh gives. And so on almost every level, he's disappointing for the author. Now, in terms of tensions that we see in him, I think there are several things that we could point out, but I think they mostly go in the direction that Yaqub Kadri has led us to. That is, he's a negative character. The tensions aren't really apparent because we don't get to hear much from Nur Baba himself. We just see his actions and we hear what the narrator interprets them as. But I think you're right that there are a lot of tensions in the novel with regard to how it presents Sufism. The main one I would say is that the author begins with a very enthusiastic and positive attraction towards Sufism. He's very interested in Sufi philosophy. He's very interested in Sufi poetry and literature. But the tension for him is his disappointment with the actual practitioners of Sufism that he encounters in early 20th century Istanbul. And so I make a point in the introduction and elsewhere that this is really a symptom of the modern engagement with Sufism, which I would say is basically a romantic approach. And I think it characterizes a lot of the scholarship in our field about Sufism, which is often labeled as Orientalism or simply Romanticism. But the novel really shows that this tension is very much present in intellectuals of the period as well. They were attracted to the traditions and the intellectual repertoire, the literature of Sufism, but they were not so excited about contemporary Sufis, or especially the leaders, or the institutions, which they saw as harmful toward the family, toward society, towards progress. And I think that this is also the same theme that we see in a lot of scholarship on Sufism, especially, I would say, the early generations of scholars, A.J. Arbery, for example, and others, who you might say have had a kind of Protestant approach to Sufism. They liked belief, they liked the content, but they really didn't care for items that they considered to be superstitious, such as tomb visitation or miracles or these sorts of things. So that comes through very clearly in the novel. And I think that's why the novel is very good for teaching Sufism in classrooms and discussing this kind of romantic, or if you want, Orientalist dynamic that is a characteristic of the field.
The other character that, of course, really deserves discussion and is a very fascinating and, again, some very interesting tensions in here in this character as well is that of Nigar, who initially is hesitant to join this order, but then eventually, of course, is enraptured with love. And that's a theme I want to come back to in a moment, the theme of love. But tell us a bit about this character, Nigar. Who is she? What is the role that she plays in the novel? And what do you see her character representing, and some of the desires and tensions that this character embodies, the one of Nigar?
Sure. Nigar is a very beautiful young woman. She is from a wealthy family that lives in a large mansion beside the Bosphorus. She's married and has several children. But she's a very bored person in this comfortable family life of wealth and prestige. But she has an aunt, let's say a somewhat disgraced aunt, who attends this Sufi lodge and ultimately invites her to come to it. And you're right, at first she's reluctant to come. She plays hard to get and so forth. She's initially a bit repulsed by the Sheikh Nur Baba. But then she is drawn in and she is initiated. She begins a flirtation with Nur Baba that then becomes a full-fledged romance. And then she enters a state in which she is the, let's say, the most prestigious woman in the order because she is in a relationship with Nur Baba. But others around her warn her and counsel her that this won't last forever and be careful. And they're right because her relationship with Nur Baba changes over time as she ages. And I won't spoil it for you, but things get dark for Nigar. So what I think the character of Nigar communicates through the novel is actually one of the main themes that the author wants to give us. That is, women who leave the home, who become disciples of sheikhs, who don't spend all their time with their family, get manipulated. They get manipulated or they get used because they are susceptible to falling in love. They're susceptible to be pushed and pulled in every which way and ultimately abused. And I think that's something that's going on in the period. This early, you know, early decades of the 20th century were, this was a period in which women were becoming more visible in public during the Young Turk period. They were getting more education. They were seen more in public, as we can see in photographs and art from the period. They were becoming writers. And in the minds of many people like Yaqub Kadri, this was a threat to the family, a threat to society. They weren't quite sure what to think about the more public roles that women were playing. And so I think this comes through very clearly in the novel, both in the character of Nigar, but also in many other female characters who are criticized for being away from the house, for leaving their children with nannies, and for basically giving this Bektashi Sufi sheikh a place to control their lives. So I think that's the main message that Nigar kind of conveys to us. I don't know, Sherali, what do you think? What did you see when you read the novel? How does Nigar strike you?
Well, as a conflicted person, certainly, who's trying to navigate both family relations with her aunt and this new context that she's thrown into. And I think the ending, not giving anything away, also is quite poignant in the kind of the lack of resolution, you know, with which the novel ends. That, I think, is in some ways also characteristic of this character, that there is this lack of resolution to these competing desires and tensions that she embodies. I want to turn now to one of the key themes of this novel that runs throughout the novel, which is that of love, intimacy, or muhabbat. Talk a little about, you know, that concept, how that concept or that category operates in the novel, and why is it so important to the texture of this novel, this whole idea of love, intimacy, and muhabbat.
Absolutely. So, of course, many of us will be familiar with the idea of ashq in Sufi poetry and so forth, and this metaphor of love between the human being and God, often expressed through different metaphors of love between a man and a woman, and many others. But what happens in the novel is that the author plays with another concept of love, which is muhabbet. Aşk does not come up much in the novel. And he chooses muhabbet because that is a particularly important term in the Bektashi Sufi order. Muhabbet has several different meanings, and the entire novel plays with the concept and does it many different ways. So, for example, muhabbet means a kind of ceremony in which people are having some drinks and reciting poetry and talking around a banquet together. But of course, it also means a certain kind of love or affection or intimacy. In Turkish, in common Turkish, not as a technical term, it can often mean just chatting, having friendly conversation. And the author wants to examine the relationship between Sufi metaphorical love for God via this romantic relationship with the sheikh. So we have many different female characters in the novel professing their muhabbet for Nur Baba, and they see it as a kind of way to divine love. So loving the sheikh isn't just loving him, it's also engaging in a kind of divine relationship, intercourse of some sorts. The novel uses this word muhabbet something like 40 times. And it's one of the few terms that I did not translate in the novel, because to do so would really lose a lot of the texture. And I try to alert the reader at different points. The novel also defines this concept in many different places, in several different ways. And toward the end of the novel, Nigar comes to this kind of personal realization, understanding of what muhabbet is. And for her, it means to love no matter how much you suffer, no matter what people do to you, no matter what comes your way, you love. You love others, you love the universe, and you don't hold a grudge. And we also see the author admiring this kind of love in some of the characters. There's another male character who many of the other members of the lodge make fun of, pick on, insult, but he's never bothered by these. And he never responds. He never shows irritation. And this is one of those instances where we see the author admiring something of the ethos of this Bektashi Sufi order, which otherwise he has a lot of critical things to say about. Now,
please go on.
I think that's enough. I think that's just enough.
Okay, terrific.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, let's think a bit about the reception of this novel. We've already discussed a bit the controversy it's created, etc. But I find it interesting that on the one hand, there is this controversy whether it caricatures the Bektashi Sufi tradition or not and lampoons it or not. But then it also has a very long-running reception as a classic of modern Ottoman literature, etc. How do you account for that? What do you make of the reception of this novel? Is it the controversy that really sustained it? Is it an articulation of a certain modernism that accounts for this reception, or there's a certain kind of rupture in what we might consider to be mainstream Sufism that accounts for it? How do you read the reception of this novel and its long-running popularity in some ways?
Sure. So the controversy is important, but the controversy happened for a reason. And this is, I think, because of the unique position of the Bektashi Sufi order at this time in history. And that's because the order was actually banned by the Ottoman Empire in 1826 and suppressed. But it went underground and actually was then tolerated for several decades by the empire. It was never officially legal again until the Turkish Republic. But in this period when the novel is being written, this is the incubation period of Turkish nationalist ideas. And Turkish nationalist thinkers were looking in all sorts of places to find sources of Turkish culture that would be the content of Turkish national culture, something different than Ottoman or Islamic culture. And the Bektashi order had a long tradition of maintaining its literature and its rituals in Turkish language. And because of that, it offered a wide variety of texts and resources from which to draw for building this new national literature, poetry, etc. Many of these thinkers were also kind of amateur anthropologists or sociologists, and they thought that you could find some of the characteristics of the pre-Islamic Turkish nation in this order's rituals, social practices, etc. For example, in Bektashi ceremonies, men and women both participate. This was promoted by many as a kind of evidence that Turkish society should be modern with mixed gender, public events, a modern society where men and women do things together, right? This was a big theme of the early Turkish Republic as well, promoting the unveiling of women, promoting women in professions, the education of women, etc. And so the Bektashi order had this unique position in nationalist thought, which is probably why Yakup Kadri Karo Osmanoglu went and joined this order in the first place. He was probably excited by these intellectual currents, which he and many other writers and thinkers of the time were dealing with. So the novel's published in 22, but then just 1 year later, the Republic is established. And so this novel and this whole thinking of about nationalist culture and what would be national culture takes on a new level of importance. And this novel is discussed really widely in 1925, 26, etc. And so it became enshrined. Now, it also has another reason, Sher Ali, and that is because in 1925, the Turkish Republic banned Sufi orders and banned all institutions, practices, titles, clothing associated with Sufism. And that meant that this novel took on a new meaning. It could now be read as a critical, accurate portrait of how depraved, of how dangerous Sufi leaders were in society, and therefore it became a justification for this legal regime of prohibiting Sufi orders and also confiscating their properties. So the novel has all three of these, the controversy, the nationalist angle, as well as this issue with the prohibition of the Sufi orders. It's also a very engaging novel. So I think that shouldn't be underestimated in terms of its success. Yaqub Kadri is a very good writer. And after this novel, he wrote many others, and they became part of the school curriculum in Turkey. So they're basically classics in the canon of modern Turkish literature.
I want to turn to another character that I found really fascinating, and different from Nigar, but also with a similar kind of oscillation between, being rejected and being embraced and accepted at different moments in the novel. And that's, of course, Madame Ziba. Tell us a bit about who this character is. How is she related to Nigar and Nur Baba? And what is the place of this character in terms of the everyday workings of the lodge and other relationships that are entangled as in the course of this novel? And tell us a bit about this character, I think, which is quite fascinating and interesting in the context of the novel.
Yes, Madame Ziba is the grand dame of the lodge. That is to say, she's the most powerful woman in the lodge, and that is because she had a long romantic affair with Nur Baba, and her money funded the lodge, made it into a viable institution, and she also comes from the same family as Nigar, obviously. She's her aunt. So this is a wealthy family, and she's the daughter of a high Ottoman statesman. They also have a nice mansion on the Bosphorus. And Nigar is interesting from a number of respects. One is that she shows that, yes, women had powerful positions in the lodge, but the author plays with this and kind of shows us that that power is illusory, that in fact, they can be discarded whenever the sheikh wants, and that the sheikh will ultimately move on to new, younger, wealthier women when possible. So Nigar's interesting also, Ziba is also interesting because at the beginning of the novel, her relationship with Nur Baba has become somewhat sour, and she harbors a grudge with him for not being as close to her as he used to. And for this reason, she wants to get some kind of revenge on Nur Baba. And so she uses her niece, Nigar, as a kind of way of teasing and tempting and playing with the sheikh's mind. At the same time, she's conflicted because she really still loves Nur Baba, and she doesn't want Nigar Hanım to become his new love. So we see this rivalry between relatives within the lodge over the love of the sheikh, over the place of prestige. And Ziba also is a character who, contributes a lot to the lodge, but is then somewhat drained by the lodge and actually leaves and is able to leave without completely destroying her life. So these are some of the angles that I see, Sherali. Have you seen something else that I should expound upon?
No, that sounds great. That sounds terrific. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is the place of Istanbul in this novel. As a reader, you really get a great sense of the architecture, geography, you know, these mansions in the Bosphorus, where the lodges and where these people then eventually, when they leave the lodge, where they reside. So there is a certain kind of a geography of Istanbul which pervades this novel throughout. And you've also presented some very useful images in the context of the book, which are very helpful. Tell us a bit about that. When you were translating this book, it seems quite clear that you very deliberately made sure that the spatial imagery of this novel really comes through in translation. So tell us a bit about that, the space of the novel and the and the way in which it, you know, represents Istanbul and its significance to this novel a bit.
Yeah, so a number of years ago, I went to the site where the lodge used to be, and I took a bus, and then I took a taxi, and then I walked, and it was shocking how high it was on a hill, on the Bosphorus, on the Asian side of the Bosphorus. You go up and up and up, steep roads, and you can really see how isolated it must have been in the late 19th, early 20th century, where this novel is based. I think this spatial element is really interesting for several reasons. The one I want to comment on the most is where it takes place. So actually, the novel takes place in a very elite part of Istanbul. It takes place in the parts of Istanbul where wealthy people went and where Europeans went. There's not a single scene in the novel that takes place in what we'd call like majority Muslim neighborhoods, right? So you have these large mansions on the Bosphorus, and it's worth noting that many of the residences of foreign ambassadors were on the Bosphorus. The major American university, Robert College, which then became Boğaziçi University later, is there. And so it's interesting that it's mostly here and then in the quarter, which is called Pera, which is known as the European quarter of Istanbul in the 19th century. It was where many foreign embassies were located, where nightlife was located, where a number of churches were and still are today. And so we see what the lives of these people would have been like, where they would have gone shopping, how they would have made their way from here to there, usually with a ferry and then with a carriage, or just with a carriage. And it really helps us see several things also about the Bektashi Sufi lodges. Actually, none of them were located within the old city walls. None of them were in old Istanbul. They were all outside of the city proper, mostly on hills, top of hills, so somewhat isolated. And you see that throughout the novel, the characters are in isolated places. They're in dark places, or they're on ferry boats, and so on. So I really like how the author describes the city in the novel. You see the beauty. You also see the loneliness. You see the insufficiencies in certain places. But I think what comes through mostly is this beauty of the Bosphorus and the presence that body of water has on the lives of these people, who are mostly, most of the characters that are dealt with a lot in the novel are wealthy people who have mansions. And then we have a couple of other characters, right? We have this celibate dervish who is named Chinadi, who shows us a completely different side. And we also have Nurbaba, who comes from a very, very humble background. He's actually found as an orphan in central Anatolia and brought to Istanbul by the previous leader of the lodge. And I think that the author tries to make some kind of class commentary through the juxtaposition of these very humble and rough Sufis, who are the professional Sufis, let's say, the leader, and this celibate dervish who actually lives in the lodge, and their interactions with elite Istanbulites who come for various reasons, but mostly for reasons that are presented as being somewhat illegitimate or not so ethical. That is, to have a relationship with the sheikh, a romantic one, or B, to come for a kind of party. And these were things that were happening in the late Ottoman period. Some Sufi lodges became kind of refuges from late Ottoman absolutism. They became what some authors called dens of perdition, places where you could drink and party and so forth without so much state surveillance of your activities. And what we find is that the author often comments negatively on this interaction between elites like Nigar and people like Nurbaba and Chinari. And I think what is mostly upsetting to the author is that there's a role reversal. That is, these wealthy, cultivated people should be at the top of society, but when they go to a Sufi lodge, they end up becoming dominated by figures who come from humble backgrounds just because they have spiritual authority or charisma. And I think this is one of the ways in which the author understands Sufi lodges as being chaotic for society, for social order, and for the family. It gives these kind of humble figures a lot of power over people who should be elites, who should be in control.
So the final question I want to ask you is about the whole craft of translation. This is a really lyrical English translation that I thoroughly enjoyed. And it's an actually very enjoyable text. I should just mention that. And hence it will work particularly well in different class settings and different courses. And you've, of course, written a lot about translation. Your first book was a magnificent book on Quran translation in the context of the Ottoman period and modern Turkey. So tell us about some of the decisions that you had to take as a translator, what you learned about this craft. Walk us through or tell us a bit about that process of translation. What was it like for you? What were some of the key challenges and how did you try to overcome those challenges? Tell us a bit about what it was like to be a translator.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that you thought it was flowing and lyrical, Sher Ali, because I can tell you with full confidence that for many years it was unreadable and it was painful to look at. I would say it gave the term wooden translation, you know, new resonance, new meaning. So, you know, I have no training in translation. I have only learned to translate by translating. And I began this project at Duke University as an independent study in which I basically told Erda Güknar, our wonderful teacher, mentor, colleague there, that I wanted to work on translations of this novel, and would he be willing to sit down with me and go through them? And he agreed to very generously, and we did that for a couple of years. And you know, if you look back at those early translations, they are just horrible. And even I would say 1 year ago, 6 months ago, when I go back and look at those drafts, they're still very, very difficult to read. So it took a long time to get to where it is now. In terms of approach, in terms of difficulties, wow, where do we start? we can talk about several things. One would be technical terminology. There are really a lot of technical Sufi terms and even beyond that, technical Bektashi terms that you have to decide what to do with. I basically took an approach where I tried to translate as many of them as possible, but in certain cases, I decided that we would just have to keep it in the original and add a footnote or add some kind of explanation in the text. Another challenge, poetry. The novel has quite a number of citations of poetry from famous Sufi poets, from Fuzuli to Nedim. And, you know, these are quite challenging. So I hope that those are relatively successful. I had fun translating them, but they were also the things that took the longest to get smooth. The author uses very, very long sentences, which is common in Ottoman Turkish. And some translators decide to preserve those sentences. I chose to break them up because in many cases they're difficult, if not impossible, to make them work really well. Another challenge would be titles. So in Turkish, it's very common to use titles of relationships like sister, brother, father, mother, aunt, uncle, etc. every time that the name is used. And in the first translations, I included those titles. But when you read it in English like that, it sounds kind of ridiculous. And so I took the vast majority of those out, and I either use them only on the first instance, or I use them consistently for characters who have a title name that's really distinctive or important to their identity. These are all very debatable choices, Shirali. But in the end, the entire translation is a series of tough choices. And there's a kind of argument for preserving the original text as much as possible versus doing something else with it. I would say I started with that mentality that I really wanted to preserve as much as possible. But the longer I translated, the less and less viable I felt that became. And I thought it became unviable mostly because it was very uncharitable to the reader. And the reader will be someone reading in English, not someone who's reading in Turkish. And the people who can read it in Turkish can read the original, and it's not a problem. So the reader, the recepting side, is favored in this translation. I had a lot of help as well, as you saw maybe in the acknowledgments. I couldn't have done this without my wonderful doctoral student, Merve Demirkan. She went through the entire text after I had finished the complete draft and made so many improvements and found quite a number of errors that it was really a godsend that she did that. And I have consulted virtually every friend I have that works on Turkish language or Ottoman language to ask different questions over the years. This has taken, you know, an unbelievable amount of time to finish, and it was probably a kind of a misguided quest to do this. But if you have enjoyed reading the novel, Shirali, then I'm very, very happy, and it was all worth it.
Well, no, this was, it really was. It was just as a reader and also as an instructor, I'm really excited about teaching this. So as we're coming to the end of our time, Brett, could you share a bit with our listeners about what are you currently working on and what might be the next book we might expect from you or anticipate from you?
Yeah, absolutely. Now I'm writing a book about Sufism in the early Turkish Republic, and it focuses on the suppression and abolition of the Sufi orders in 1925. This is an event that we hear about in many different histories of the Middle East or histories of Islam or Sufism, but we really lack a detailed, in-depth study of this issue. So hopefully by the end of the year, I can finish this manuscript up and send it in. And it's obviously closely related to the themes that we looked at today in Nurbaba. So I'm hoping that it will be a fresh take on secularism in the Muslim world in the early 20th century, which kind of looks closely at how Sufism, Sufi institutions, Sufi culture made the transition from the age of empire to the age of the nation state, and how it played in sometimes unacknowledged but rather important role in the secularities that emerged in Turkey as well as in other Middle Eastern or Muslim majority states. So that's where I'm at now, Shirali.
Noor Baba, published by Routledge, Hot of the Press 2023, and translated by Professor Brett Wilson. Brett, thank you so much for your time and for these wonderful responses and commentaries in the novel, and for composing this really, really terrific translation that I'm sure all of us will benefit from. Thank you so much for coming on the New Books Network.
I really enjoyed speaking with you, Charlie, and I look forward to doing it again.
So this was my conversation with Professor Brett Wilson about his translation of Noor Baba. I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. And I hope you will also join us next time. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.